I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Is CEOs and senior leaders, or senior managers, sorry, are really great at saying it's the most important thing. And yet when you ask them, oh, how much are you spending, how much time are you taking on your culture? They're like, oh, well, we've got a learning and development budget of X dollars. And it's like, yeah, that's not it. That's only one small part of it. I think most of them expect it to magically evolve. So they'll say it's the most important thing. But then they'll expect one or two charismatic people to have a huge effect on it and hope that it just evolves itself into something unique, something different, and something that works. And that just doesn't happen. You have to be, like most things in life, you have to be very deliberate about its creation, about its evolution, in order to set the tone for I guess the environment that you need to create to be successful. And it's something that we've seen during COVID, is teams had to change and organizations had to change overnight. The ones that were deliberate about their culture prior to COVID found it very, very easy to change. For everybody else, most of them are still struggling to do it.
How you day? That was the voice of Colin. Now you're going to hear a lot from Colin. In fact, that's what the episode is about. Colin educating you on the importance of building a culture. And I found a lot of the things he said very poignant to today. And I think they're applicable to any system that you participate in, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's in the education institution, whether it's in your family. And please, please, please do not underestimate the power of what creating a powerful culture can do and the long-standing effects that they have. That's my hope for you with this episode. Hope you enjoyed.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of As Told by Nomads. Today, I'm talking to Colin D. Ellis, who is a renowned culture change expert with 30 plus years of experience of transforming organizations all around the world. His new book is called Culture Fix: How to Create a Great Place to Work. And I'm really excited for this, not only because it's something that I am involved in as well with my line of work, but I do think people and organizations are thinking that they can't create great places to work right now, given the current situation. So I'm very excited to hear his thoughts on this. Welcome to the show, Colin.
Thanks, Theo. It's great to be here, my friend.
The pleasure is mine. So let's do a deep dive. Let's go back to early Colin, right? So are you from Australia or just based in Australia right now?
No. Australia is home now, Theo. I'm originally from Liverpool in the UK, home of the Beatles, of course.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. You said home of the Beatles. I was thinking something else because, you know, I'm a deep Manchester United fan.
Let's spend the podcast talking about football. Yeah, I mean, when you grow up in Liverpool, like it you either become a footballer, a musician, or you leave. So it's one of those three things. So I left.
So you're not involved in the rivalry between Manchester United and Liverpool then?
Well, if you're born in Liverpool, you support a team called Everton. There are two teams in Liverpool. There's Liverpool and Everton, right? So if you're born in Liverpool, you support Everton. If you're born in, I don't know, New York, you support Liverpool or Man United. So that's the way it works. Yeah. So I'm a big Everton fan.
Yeah, no, so I'm from Nigeria, and in obviously Nigeria, I grew up calling what people call soccer here football.
That's right.
And my love affair with Manchester United started, I think, with the class of David Beckham and the whole team, Gary Neville and everyone. So yes, Ah, okay. Yeah. Well, at least it's safe. It's safe to continue this conversation. Now
it is. We're all good. We're all good. Yeah. Yeah.
So you were saying before I interrupted, you
so grew Liverpool, up, yeah. Yeah. Grew up in Liverpool. Liverpool was home. Didn't do very well in school, Teo. Wasn't really my thing, education. And I just wanted a job to earn money to buy records. That was just my sole purpose in life. And then started working. Yeah, found that I really enjoyed interacting with people and customers, and then really kicked on from there. But I think everything changed for me in the late 90s. I was asked to become a project manager. I didn't really know what a project manager was, if I'm honest. The world was going through this year 2000 meltdown. And so I got involved in that, kind of had to learn the ropes pretty quickly. But even though I'd been part of good teams, that was my first opportunity to create teams myself. And so kind of everything changed after that. I found that I loved being in those high pressure situations, taking risk, you know, really fostering a sense of belonging between different teammates. So I kind of rose up the ranks. I was working for a newspaper there, rose up the ranks there, then went to work for a clothing retailing company in the UK. And then we emigrated to New Zealand in 2007. I was offered a couple of jobs. And at that time, we had a young boy. We had another one on the way. And so it felt like the right thing to do to move to New Zealand. And then 6 years there for me working in government. And then we emigrated to Australia in 2013. And we've been here ever since.
That's incredible. And I love stories like that, because one of the things that you recognized, which is a great self-awareness on your part, is you recognized that the traditional schooling as it was, wasn't your thing. It wasn't something that you are interested in, but you were interested in people. And you, I think you even stumbled upon that by following your curiosity. You took on something that was a job, something to do. And in the process of that, I think you extrapolated the concept you liked about that, and then you started intentionally looking for those things as you moved in different parts of the world, it seems.
Yeah, that's true. When I was at school, back when I was at school, not that I remember too much about it now, Teo, but I was one of these kids that had plenty of potential, but kind of didn't know how to apply themselves. I was quite a good football player, so I thought that I would become a footballer. That didn't happen. I then kind of just drifted from one idea to the next. And I think I see the same in my son right now. He's almost 14. But I don't think that they taught us enough at school, and they still don't teach enough in school about some of those crucial elements of how to survive in the business world. So things like communication skills, things like listening skills, all of these things become crucially important. And so I found that when I started work, it was kind of a real rapid development for me, because some of the things that I'd learned about were just not relevant. You know, kind of, yeah. I was doing maths on a calculator. All of the history stuff that I was doing kind of wasn't relevant at all. And yet I hadn't learned any of the things that I actually needed is how do I communicate to people who aren't me? If someone's really boring, how do I listen to them without getting distracted? Still have that problem. And so I think that, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is help our kids. We want them to make sure, and they're third culture kids as well, of course, because all of the cultural references that we had are from the UK.
Yeah.
They've grown up in New Zealand and Australia. They're kind of developing their own cultural skills, trying to almost ignore the references that we're giving them. But you know, we want to make sure that they learn as they should learn, but we're also, as parents, trying to give them the life skills at the same time so that they're better prepared for work.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love that. And I wanted to set that context for the audience, because I like to give the audience just a perspective on how the guest thinks, because your big idea is you're saying business leaders are aware that their organization's viability directly relates to its culture. And, you know, you said the research shows 92% of senior executives cite culture as a critical driver to their company, yet only 16% say that culture is exactly, you know, that their culture is exactly where it should be. So if most people know that culture is a big driver, how come a lot of people have fallen short on creating that company culture that they so desire?
It's a great question, Teo. It continually baffles me. Is CEOs and senior leaders or senior managers, are really great at saying it's the most important thing. And yet when you ask them, how much are you spending, how much time are you taking on your culture? They're like, we've got a learning and development budget of X dollars. And it's like, yeah, that's not it. That's only one small part of it. I think most of them expect it to magically evolve. So they'll say it's the most important thing. But then they'll expect one or two charismatic people to have a huge effect on it and hope that it just evolves itself into something unique, something different, and something that works. And that just doesn't happen. You have to be, like most things in life, you have to be very deliberate about its creation, about its evolution, in order to set the tone for I guess the environment that you need to create to be successful. And it's something that we've seen during COVID. Its teams had to change and organizations had to change overnight. The ones that were deliberate about their culture prior to COVID found it very, very easy to change. For everybody else, most of them are still struggling to do it.
Yeah, and you're so right with this. So I agree with you. Even though I work as a consultant, which I love that you stressed this in your book, you said you shouldn't rely on a consultant. I say the same thing to companies where when they ask me to come on to work with them, I ask them if this is going to be a one-off or if you just think that this is going to be an inspiring speech and then you're not going to do anything else about it. I just want to let you know up front that this isn't going to get you that desired change because there isn't a structure in place and it's not going to become a habit. But if you feel like this is something that you truly want to do, you have to figure it out to empower the audience and your employees, but also, you know, back it up with your finances and your investment and then the actions, because then it's going to become this. We hear you say this every time around this time of the year, and we might buy into it for the first week and then it fades away afterwards. So I love that you brought that. And you have six pillars. You said six pillars.
Yeah, I do. I have six pillars for workplace culture, which are really based on, I researched all the great workplace cultures around the world, but then I worked in cultures for 30 years. So, I'm really well placed to know what works and what doesn't. I always stress that I'm not a consultant, because one of the things that I want to do is to help people. Whenever I talk to CEOs or senior managers, and often they'll say, we want you to help us change it. I say, okay, well, how much are you prepared to change yourself? And then how much money and time are you going to put behind this initiative? And if I don't get the answer that I'm looking for, then I generally say, this is not for you. You're looking for a quick fix. And usually it's in one of those kind of six pillar areas that they're looking for a quick fix, when actually every kind of all elements of it need work. But I want to know that they're committed to it at the start, Tao, before I start working, because otherwise what happens is they want, can you just come in and do a 2-day training course? I'm like, well, I kind of can, but what's the plan after that to kind of keep it going? Plus, I'm not really training you. I'm giving you the skills to create something yourself. And I want you to do it while I'm actually there. Because only then have you got something actually you can take, we can define those six pillars and the rubber can hit the road immediately. And then we can talk about accountability and then we can talk about evolution. But until then, what you want to do is buy something off the shelf. We've seen the same with Agile recently. Everyone's going Agile, but they don't really understand what it means. And so you want to see that commitment, because only with that commitment to personal change and personal development at the very top, do you get it below the.
No, I say the same thing. So it's refreshing to hear, you say that as well, especially given the years of experience you have. But let's say someone's listening. This is a CEO. This is a senior executive, and they do want to know. They're curious about the six pillars, though. I mean, you don't have to dive into it in depth because I want the audience to get the book. But what are the actual six pillars that you would say if you could name them?
Sure. Yeah. So the first pillar is personality and communication, because the way into any culture is through its people. So if the people don't understand each other and don't know how to communicate a message in different ways to different personalities, you've kind of lost before you've even started. And so organizations are great at doing things like personality surveys, but it never really changes the dynamic of the way people interact. So that's the first thing, because, you know, that's something that you see when you go for an interview. That's something you see in the everyday interactions. And then the second pillar is vision. At the heart of every great culture is an aspirational statement of the future, something short, sharp, meaningful, achievable, but just a little bit out of reach. It's got to feel like a stretch target, right? Because if it's too easy to get there, then it's not really a vision. Also, if it's too difficult or doesn't really mean anything, it's just going to confuse the heck out of people. So it's got to be short, sharp, and kind of have that sense of challenge. So that's the second one. The third one is values, and the values provide emotional direction. These are the things that inform our decision making. These are the things that inform our hiring. Because what we want to do is we want to hire people who share our values. Because then what you do is create connection and a sense of belonging. When you create a sense of belonging, it increases motivation and inspiration. And of course, you get the results that you're looking for. So a strong set of values, again, not generic statements. There's so many organizations that bring in branding consultants rather than use their own people to define this stuff. And then they wonder why they're rejected by the staff. It's like, well, because they haven't been involved in the creation. The fourth pillar is around behavior, because human behavior dictates pretty much everything that happens within our culture. So you need to agree, what are the behaviors that we expect of each other? Now, those behaviors may differ from team to team. They may differ from year to year. So it's important that you set the behaviors for now. Most CEOs, organizations, they have a set and forget approach to culture. Let's set it now, and then we're done for the next 5 years. Well, cultures evolve naturally. And in order to evolve them positively, you have to take deliberate action. And those behaviors, they kind of hold people to account in terms of, well, what's acceptable in terms of your performance and the way that you interact with other human beings. The fifth one is collaboration. So how we work together, that agreement on the processes that we need, the systems that we use, the technology that supports us, the workspace we design, whether people are in the office, out of the office. But really those daily, weekly, monthly interactions in order to achieve our goals. And then the very last pillar is innovation, is how are we making time for new ideas? How are we making time to be creative? Mm. And what are we learning from failure? You know, what are those things that we're doing to make sure that we don't make the same mistakes over and over again? And so, you know, the research shows that if you've got all of those six pillars and people are held account to them, you have a vibrant workplace culture that continually hits its results.
I mean, I love all that. And I 100% agree. One of the things that you and I talked about, though, before this, was that because of COVID, you're hearing a lot of companies even scramble because, I don't know, I'm going to do this for remote employees. So I was thinking about one of the things you said. How would you then assess something like a performance evaluation for your remote employees now with this? Because if a company didn't do a good job of setting up that company culture before this, I imagine it's going to be increasingly tough to figure out how to, I guess, evaluate employees and then motivate employees in a remote format.
Yeah, it is. It's not impossible. So, you know, kind of a lot of the work that I've done during COVID, because a lot of the work that I do, of course, is large groups of people. You know, I'm a conference speaker. I've not been doing any of that except virtually. you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
And so, you know, I kind of opened up my calendar, gave my time away for free. And so most of the conversations I've been having with teams around the world is that, all right, we're remote. How do we set our culture up for success? And I say, okay, well, what do you do to define your culture beforehand? It's like, nothing. Okay, right. So you're almost starting from scratch. I mean, it's one of those things that can be done. I think the important thing to point out right now is this is not a normal remote scenario. You know, we had Jack Dorsey at Twitter came out yesterday and said, if people want to work from home forever, they can do, which is cool, right? And I love that. And there have been so many poorly behaving people getting in the way of workplace flexibility. But this right now is not normal. And so you might really enjoy working from home right now because you've got your family around you. what happens when your wife's back at work, your kids are back at school, and you're sat at home on your own? Is that still going to be the same? Are you still going to feel the same? Yeah. But you still have to agree those kind of core pillars for workplace culture. So you still need a vision. You still need generally the vision and the values are set at an organization level. So I've been encouraging teams to agree a set of behaviors in the way that they're going to work together. Because overnight we went from back-to-back meetings, which is a nonsense, to everything on Zoom, which is also a nonsense, because teams didn't agree how they would work together, how they would stay connected. So, you know, right now, you know, I'm advising teams agree a core set of behaviors between 3 and 5 and some principles about the way that you'll collaborate. What will you use? When will you use it? How will you set expectations and how will you hold each other to those such that the business keeps moving forward?
Yeah, I'm hearing, you know, allowing for flexibility, because I'm doing the same thing you're doing. You know, right before COVID, I was set to go on a few, you know, speaking engagements. And I was like, yeah, March, April, this is coming out. And then bam. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get a lot of requests from people because everyone is scrambling and saying, wait, remote, what is remote? I've never done this. If, you know, especially organizations that have never done that. But the same thing, I opened up a lot of my calendar because I actually was very curious about this because I've never experienced a global pandemic before. So I wanted to collect and gather information. And the things that I got in based on my research were, I don't know how to be productive or how to manage productivity. I'm a micromanager. And so it's better for me when I can see my employee doing something because I can correct that person. Or we have several people in our team who are at different stages. I trust this person, but not that person. This person is a new hire. We didn't finish this. And so those things. So I definitely can see how the pillars help, because certainly those are the strongest foundations to have. And the vision will definitely help you to understand what they're doing. But it sounds like you're also saying, given that this is not even a normal remote situation, there needs to be some flexibility where you are able to meet somewhere in the middle and discuss expectations versus, you know, ability to work within those parameters.
Flexibility, you know, what would be great post-COVID is that flexible working became mainstream. It's always bothered me that it had to be approved by someone high up. And, you know, that sense that trust wasn't assumed within cultures. Now, in the great workplace cultures, trust is assumed. You get to design your own day. You get to design your own week. But if you don't deliver, Teo, you're out of a job.
Yes.
So all these great cultures around the world are brutal if you don't deliver, and rightly so. But that's why they're great. Why they're great is they give their employees every kind of opportunity to grow, to succeed, all of that stuff. But if you don't do the job, you're out. Most stagnant cultures, or I call them combatant cultures, is you can get away with not delivering, and we make excuses for it and we walk past it. But most managers aren't great at setting expectation in the right way. Instead, what they want to do, exactly as you said, is they want to micromanage in a 9-to-5 office environment. You know, open plan, right? I'm just going to quickly mention open plan. Open plan is proven not to work. And yet organizations do it because they think it improves collaboration. It doesn't. It just makes people more visible, literally more visible in the office. Also, it's now really bad because we've proven that it's a great way to spread disease. So it'll be interesting to see if they dial that back.
Anyone that is not a fan of open plan can just say, look, I don't want to contract any disease.
Hot desk it. Hot desk and proven to kill collaboration also spreads disease. So dial that right back. So what we did was we pulled down barriers to make people more visible so that managers who had a trust issue could see people. And so, you know, it's about fixing the skill set of managers in order to make flexibility mainstream, because, you know, right now, I think we've seen what the COVID crisis showed more than anything else is that there are a bunch of people in leadership positions who barely know how to manage.
And it's very important to distinguish between leading and managing, by the way, because you're so right. That's the point. You know, a lot of people could be appointed leadership positions, But when you don't know how to manage people or work with people from different backgrounds, it is so evident. Now, one of the things that I don't know if you agree with this, I think a core element of learning how to manage or even lead that intersection is being able to communicate, but also being able to be vulnerable. I think a lot of people now, but you know, felt like they couldn't be honest with their employees because it would be a sign of weakness. And so, you know, they'll take on a lot of things and they won't admit that there's a sense of overwhelm and stress that's affecting them.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone, and I found that there's more respect when you just say, look, this is where we are. We could be better, but this is how we're feeling. I want to invite collaboration from all of you and see where you all are and see maybe we can, you know, work within these parameters as opposed to just acting like everything is okay and then, you know, inevitably flaming.
I agree with that 100%. Teo, vulnerability is a superpower. For too long, it's something that we've kept in a phone box at the edge of a street, not wanting to talk about. It literally is the way to create human connection. You know, one of the things that I did very early on in the COVID crisis I encourage managers to share their story, share how they're coping with the disease. And one of the great things that we've seen, there haven't been many great world leaders during the crisis. There have been many managers telling us exactly what we can't do, but very few leaders being vulnerable, kind of showing us into their world, talking about how they've been personally affected. Jacinda Ardern, who's the Prime Minister of New Zealand, has excelled in that. She did a Facebook Live session from her home after putting her baby to bed. First thing she did was apologize for the ratty jumper she was wearing, the ratty sweater she was wearing, because she just put her kids to bed. Immediately it creates connection. And I think, you know, one of the things we want one of the things that separates managers from leaders is leaders are very good at being just a little bit vulnerable. We're not talking about, we don't need to dish the family dirt. Actually, we do, but at a Christmas party after a couple of beers. we want to know a little bit about you, a little bit about how you're coping, which helps us to kind of share too, but also gives us that, I guess, comfort that they're just a human being as well.
Yeah, look, I'm so glad you brought up Jacinda Ardern because I've been fascinated. I am a nerd, so I study leaders all over the world. But I, ever since the unfortunate situation that happened, I think it was a little over a year ago, Christchurch. So I've been just in awe of just how she's handled that. And it's what you're saying, the vulnerability to be herself, because, you know, if you're juxtaposing that with many leaders around the world, whether it's Boris Johnson or 45 here in America, I'm not even trying to be political. It's the idea of not being able to admit that something, you know, this is where you are and this is how you go. It doesn't inspire collaboration unless you already have a base that will do whatever you're doing. Like that will just support whatever you're saying. And for me, I think it can be dangerous for leaders if they perpetuate dangerous habits, especially now that you can't see that. You know, if you're a leader and someone buys into the cult of who you are, right? You know, like maybe, I don't know, you know, there are many leaders like that, Elon Musk, all these amazing, smart people that have gotten to where they've gotten to. I don't want the rest of the team to model bad behaviors because they've seen how you do it. And then they're just like, that's it. That's it. He never said anything. She never said anything. Why would I say this? You know, I don't know if I'm trying to say this and explain this.
Yeah, you are. Yeah, yeah. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, because leaders set the tone, right? And I always, you know, kind of one of the things I always say is that leaders don't own the culture. It doesn't matter whether it's a country, it doesn't matter whether it's an organization, it doesn't matter whether it's a team. They don't own the culture. But through their behaviors or through their action or inaction, they've got the power to destroy it.
Yes.
Completely destroy it, right? So in times of crisis, what we don't want is your opinion. I could care less for your opinion in time of crisis. I want facts, and I want to know what we should be doing, not what we shouldn't be doing.
I feel like I'm talking to a mirror. This is exactly what I'm saying. It is about facts. That is the best way to just work with someone and be, you know, manage the anxiety. This talk about you. You know, if you want to reveal something by yourself, you can share that you're also dealing. You know, it's a confusing thing time for you as well. But
that's right.
If you're doing the other thing where you're like, I can't believe this, we lost less people than the other country.
Making it a competition. It will be a great success if we only lose this many people.
Yeah.
It's a success that people are dying? Are you kidding me? You know,
the lack of humanity is what I'm trying to say. And I'm not, once again, look, anyone can, you know, I'm sure everybody already knows how liberal I am, but the one thing that, and I'm not ashamed of it because I do believe in humanity, but one thing I do want to say to anyone listening, and I'm hearing you call and say, is you cannot forget your humanity or the humanity of the people you lead here. You are inevitably going to lead someone that disagrees with you on many aspects, especially if you're growing. But in a time of crisis, the unique thing about a crisis is that everyone is mostly experiencing or being affected by the crisis. So it's not a time for you to I don't know, figure out, hey, this person doesn't think the way I think, so I'm going to be mean to this person. You have to be able to create comfort and present facts and then work with people on different levels, regardless of what you believe and what they
regardless of your differences, absolutely right. And this is as true in workplace culture as it is within this particular crisis. You have to recognize, you know, an organization's Teo are great at saying, oh, people are our most important asset. It's like, are they though, really? Because if people were your most important asset, then you'd make sure that empathy is a default in every single manager within your business. One of the things we've seen within COVID is Corona kindness, right? It's built emotional capital. It's built connection between people, which is fabulous. And I want to see that retained. But every manager, if people are your most important asset, every manager should be able to be empathetic, should know what it means, should know how to practice it. Yeah. And there's so much that's happened during the pandemic that needs to be carried back into the workplace if organizations are to prove that they've truly learned from it. And I got to say, I'm not confident. You know, I'm an optimistic realist, right? And so I believe in the good of humanity. I believe that anybody can be anything and do anything. But the realism is that often people just don't care enough to want to do it, Teo. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm trying to help organizations see some of the benefits that we've seen of the changes that we've had as part of the crisis in the hope that they'll continue those practices moving forward.
I hope so too. You say you're an, I like the definition you described. I always describe myself that. I describe myself as an angry optimist. I'm so optimistic, but I feel like I'm angry. It's because of my anger that I want to do something. And so I'm like, no, you can do better. No, that's not the truth. Why aren't you mad?
You can do this. You can do this. You're in the way of you. You.
But yes, it does lead for some frustrating times. But I'm with you on this because I do hope that people can take some of these translatable new experiences. I have some of the same trepidations. But another thing that I was figuring out when I was doing research on you is you say You can use new projects to initiate cultural evolution. And can't think of any situation that is created more new projects than COVID. So I'm curious about that. How could new projects initiate cultural evolution?
Well, because culture is made up of a series of subcultures, Teo. What we try and do at an organization level is try and set it at the top, usually using the wrong people to do it, and then say, right, this is your culture. And obviously people reject it. Every team, every department within an organization needs to set its own culture in order to achieve the aspirations of the organization. And so digital transformation particularly happened very, very quickly with COVID. And so what you need to do, and I worked with one team on this, is you stand the team up and you get them to agree all of those good cultural elements that they need to be successful so that they can demonstrate how it's done. Now, digital transformation, which I want to just very briefly talk about. So digital is the strategy of the organization, right? Is to become more digital. The transformation piece is culture. And most organizations don't get this. They think that digital transformation is implementing Microsoft Teams. Everyone seems to be doing that at the minute. They think it's implementing new technology, but that's only part of it. In order to transform, what you need is to redefine the culture that you expect up front, so that when you embed the new tool into the new culture, it's successful. Most organizations don't do that. Most organizations, when they start their projects, just, you know, they don't even plan. They're like, we just want this as soon as we possibly can. It's like, okay, well, for any project, you have to build a team, build a plan, then deliver the project. It works in that way. And so building the team is all about, well, let's define the culture that we need to be successful, and then you can set the example, set the tone for the rest of the work that needs to happen, Teo. But this is the point that I make about organizations not really understanding culture. Because most managers will press the fast forward on creating the teams. It's like, let's just do a plan and let's get going. It's like, well, if you don't build a team, ain't nothing going to get delivered.
That's true. It's true. And the key thing there is a lot of people are on autopilot with implementation of new things, right? Whether it's technology. Oh, yeah, we need it. Everybody in the office is getting this. Bam. And then, you know, then you have people in the companies who know how to do it and some who don't know how to do it. And then people hate coming up on video. Some love coming up on video. And then that's causing random conversations where it could have been addressed if you said, hey, this is going to happen. We're moving towards this because we're going to be working with China. We're going to be working with India and then West Coast in America. So we want to be able to find a way to create humanity. I understand there will be some, you know, resistance to change. So this is how we're going to redefine this culture. These are some of the FAQs in case you have those. And these are some of the behaviors that are accepted. You know, if you created those type of things where it's not like this added pressure, even if you're still met with some resistance, it will be taken in a lot better than just, oh, yep, everybody got Zooms, webcams, now let's go. At least that's how I've thought of it. But
yeah, absolutely right. You know, kind of what we've seen, what we saw through COVID is people just saying, exactly as you said, we've got Zoom, we're going to do a Zoom call every morning without really understanding why it's important, how it's going to help the team collaborate. Everything became over Zoom when, you know, you really want a mix of interactions. So defining those, you know, you can call them rules of engagement. You can kind of call them whatever you want. But essentially, as long as the team get a say in how they're going to work together, the behaviors they expect of each other, the aspiration that they have for this particular piece of work, how they're going to make time for creative thinking. If they haven't had a say in any of that, then it's not going to work. And what you'll end up is at some stage, you'll end up in this crisis situation within your project or within your business as usual, whatever it is that you're doing. And you'll wonder how you got there. And you got there because you didn't put the deliberate time and effort into defining the culture. And you know what, Teo? People spend more money every year on computer monitors than they do on defining the culture that they need to be successful.
Or on people. They're supposed to be the assets.
Crazy. on the assets that are the most important thing. And yet we love our silver bullet situations, silver bullet solutions. We love going open plan. We love going agile. None of those things actually improve the way we work if people have still got fixed mindsets.
Yeah. And to circle back to the earlier conversation when we talked about school, one of the things, and look, I'm Nigerian. The expectation is you go to the highest level of education or else you're considered a failure. And I got my MBA, but I didn't find any of those. I didn't think it was compulsory. I think it's necessary for some people, but I don't know that the structure of the education system to bring back the people is suitable for every single person, because there are people that love that structure and need that structure, but you got to create an environment in school that allows for creativity with different types of kids to explore themselves. And I find that happening in education and in workplaces where you're stifling the creativity and the potential of people because of an archaic system that might have been better during the Industrial Revolution. Right? Whether it's the 9 to 5 hours or the measuring of productivity or all those things. You got to be able to know the students and you got to be able to know the employees. I mean, that's what I find. But
it's true, you know, and I'm not an education expert by any stretch of the imagination. But I know for a fact that the skills that my kids are being taught at school, probably 90% they'll never use. They banned mobile phones in classrooms in the state that I live in Australia. And, you know, we're talking to some parents and they're like, oh, it's a good thing. It's like, it's a bad thing. Firstly, we should be teaching our kids how to leverage technology for good. And actually, there are so many people killed on the roads every year now through digital distraction. Actually, it'd be something to be really good to teach them in classrooms. Mm-hmm. Is how to not be distracted by your device. That would be a great. Or how about we help teachers develop the technology skills to be able to deliver something that keeps kids' attention. You know, what we've seen during the Zoom classes, and of course teachers are under pressure just like everybody else.
Yes, they are. They absolutely are.
You know, and you know, one of the great things to come out of the crisis is we're actually giving credit to some of those public servants that have never got the credit that they deserved. Well, but I don't think the education system has done enough to help embed different ways of teaching. So for example, you know, I watched a video from one teacher the other day, not one in of our schools, who was using green screen technology to present his classroom. Mate, it was incredible. Now you and I as speakers know, you know, I've been doing green screen for some of my presentations. It's such a different way to engage people. But we don't teach these skills in school. We don't teach these skills in the office. You know, one of the things I'm often asked to do is can you teach us how to motivate and inspire, you know, kind of a team? I was like, well, I can teach you, but there's a significant amount of personal change required if you don't do that right now. And if you're up for it, you can totally do it. Yeah. But most people generally aren't up for it because they've got onto that 21st century Industrial Revolution treadmill of command and control cultures. And they think that by shouting at everyone or micromanaging them, then that's the pathway to success. And it's not.
It's not. And I say this as a professor. I'm an adjunct professor and I'm really passionate about these two fields, education and workplaces. It comes down to how much the system is willing to invest in the people that they say they want to manage or lead. Me having, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion as a passion, I understand different cultures learn in different ways. If you're going to teach a bunch of students the same way one culture learns, that is beyond lazy as a system. because you're going to perpetuate whatever stereotypes or narratives you have because you're only looking at it from that lens. And then, you know, it's just one of these things that I think companies and I'm going to circle back to the work culture. I think work cultures need to do the same thing. And then the other thing that I've noticed with COVID is I think a lot of companies have realized that they could be more inclusive than they thought they were, because now they're companies that need to hire people are hiring people that are, one, immunocompromised or people that have different abilities. And all of a sudden, it doesn't matter if they can show up to the office. Hey, I just need you to be able to do this job. It's okay. We'll find a way for you to do that. That type of thinking can be a new culture that I hope is extended post-COVID. Now, I have a hope for it. I don't know if it's going to happen. But those are the things that I'm talking about where I think people have been very rigid with how they define what they think their company culture should be, as opposed to inviting collaboration to create a company culture that represents the 21st century.
Totally agree. I couldn't agree more. They very, very rigid. They got a flexible working program, but you still have to be online 9 to 5. And then there's deep suspicion when you're not on 9 to 5. You know, some of the things that we've seen during the crisis is, yes, flexible working became more mainstream, which is awesome. Empathy became important. Absenteeism is a good thing. If you're sick, don't be in work. Presenteeism is a bad thing. Take some time away from the screen, right? Previously to COVID, you know, we wore 60-hour weeks like a badge of honor. Change became easier. Technology got used in the way that it should do. People had to become comfortable with it and use it. Back-to-back meetings became unworkable, you know, because they are anyway. Senior managers became visible. We didn't waste time flying into state for a one-hour meeting. All of these things are all things that organizations, it suddenly became easy to do within their cultures. And yet the great cultures were doing all of those things prior to the crisis. They were the ones that were able to pivot quickly. They were the ones that had no loss of productivity, no loss of performance. And so, you know, you're kind of hoping that organizations are now deliberate in the way that they redefine their working cultures to embed some of those things, Teo. And so, you know, I'm already talking to organizations. So here in Australia, we're likely to reopen pretty much around about June. Mm-hmm. And so already organizations approach me going, okay, well, when can we do this redefinition exercise? I'm like, well, we can do it right now. Oh, well, we're not ready. I was like, see, that's the thing with culture is it's going to evolve anyway. So you can never say that you're not ready. But yeah, I'm hopeful that they'll embed some of those learnings into the new way of doing things.
I'm hopeful and I'm glad that the world has you because we need this. We need to create more great places to work. You're a fellow Wiley author, I saw.
I didn't think I'd ever write a book, Teo. When I felt, you know, I've only been working for myself for just over 5 years, and the first year was awful. Nobody wanted a bar of what I was talking about, and so I've written four books in 4 years, and I did two last year, including Culture Fix at the end of the year.
Two last year?
I did, yeah, and I'm in the middle of writing another one right now. This is going to be my corona baby.
You know what? I'm in the middle of writing one now, but you're just way more prolific. That's incredible. Okay, so then where can people get Culture Fix? How to create a great place to work?
They can get it in Amazon is the best place right now. They can get it on Amazon or any online bookstores. You can get it. It's called Culture Fix, How to Create a Great Place to Work. And people can find more about me at colindellis.com. Or we set up a community, Teo. I didn't mention that. Because one of the things that for me, when I was in my job, there was no virtual community where I could just go and share ideas and pick up personal learning. So we created one. It's called culturefixcommunity.com. It's free to join. If you want to do some personal development, there are some online programs there that you can pay to access. We've got 500 people from around the globe now sharing ideas on how to create great workplace culture.
Love it. I love it. I'll make sure I put that in the show notes. This has been fun, Colin. I really enjoy your passion for this because I think it's funny that a lot of companies don't think that they should be defining culture now, but I think this is as good a time as any, probably the most important time to do so because it's a new normal. It's not going to return to the way it was, regardless of what happens. Yeah,
that's so right. And they get one shot to do it well. And so I'm hoping they take it.
That's true. Well, the last question I have before you go is my mission statement reframed as a question. So, Colin, how do you use your difference to make a difference?
Ah, what a great question. How do I use my difference to make a difference? For me, my difference is often that I've worked in workplace cultures for 30 years in three different countries in multiple sectors. And so what I do is I share the learnings and my own vulnerabilities in order to give people practical things that they can do to also make a difference to other people.
Boom. Well said. Well said.
If I had a microphone, I'd drop it on the floor. But
I should have. that was succinct and concise. I love it. But no, I can't express my gratitude enough for you. I really think people should, you know, check out the book. I often say we either go to school or some sort of education and go to work for most of our lives. So it's very important that in these two institutions, we understand how to experience the fullness of our humanity. And if you're a leader, it's very important that you create those spaces for that. So I'm glad that your book is out. I hope people can use it. And I'm excited for your Corona baby as well.
Thanks so much, Teo. It's been great to be on the show. Cheers.
Pleasure is mine. And ladies, gentlemen, and gender non-binary individuals, till next time, use your difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Teo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.teoroxon.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.